other tripod mounting devices that have got a lot of compliance to them. This thing goes a long way to doing a good job. So I do recommend you get one of those, and maybe with more than one mounting device. Thank you, Dave, for telling me. Gerald, ZB2ZEX, go ahead with your information, sir. K2LAW.
Astronomy Net is tentatively scheduled for the first and third Thursdays of the month, starting the first week of December. That's the latest we have. K2RAW,
ZB2ZEX. Yes, sir, Jerry. Yeah, Jerry, first and third, I think you said Thursday of the month, starting the first week in December. Is it approximately 8 o'clock? So answer that, Jerry, and then turn it over to John. You got it, Jerry.
I believe it's going to be 8:30, but I'm not sure about that, because all our other nets started, except for yours, started at 8:30.
You got it, John.
AG2WQB. Jerry, is the day of Thursday, is that fixed in stone? Because that's going to leave out one of our most active astronomers, Andy, N2HUH, who is really active, but he has no way of attending on Thursdays. I just wondered if it's possible for Tuesday, but if it's already set up, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. Just a question. Back to you, Jerry.
I have to check with, we'll have to wait till Richie gets back and check on that, but I think it's set for Thursday based upon the availability of the, you know, the moderator of the net, and I think he's available on Thursdays.
Understood. Dick?
Okay, we're all looking forward to that. That could be a good thing, because there's a lot of enthusiasm for astronomy as I see it in this group. Some of those meetings that we've had that just extemporaneously, all of a sudden guys got together like 10 o'clock at night and started talking about astronomy. It seems like a few of those have gone on for like 2 or so hours. Is that true from your recollection, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. And longer than that. I've been on it with them, Andy and the whole group. Dave pops in and out. Yeah, it's pretty active. So it's going to be an interesting, it'll be an interesting night.
Right now, astronomy and all of its many forms that NASA is conducting, and also European Space Agency and the Southern European Observatory, where the major installation is La Salina, Chile. My goodness, are they doing good things. And what's the limits? What's the limit? What's the deepest, what's the dimmest thing you can observe at the greatest distance? And you may know that they did succeed a year or two ago of observing Halley's Comet at the greatest distance from the sun, which is an object as black as a piece of coal. And I forget how many astronomical units it goes out there, but a long distance. So, and they were literally counting photons. You know, one photon per second type thing, hitting their huge telescope. I think it was a 16-foot diameter telescope that was gathering the light for a long period of time and integrating it. So,
Dick, Halley's Comet, is that the one that has a 75-year cycle?
That's the one. Halley or Holy. The family pronounces it Holy. The astronomers pronounce it Halley. And common people pronounce it Halley. But that's the one. It's roughly a 75-year period. And at the time they made the measurement, it was at its maximum distance. So that's quite an accomplishment. And what is the weakest signal you can get on a radio? What is the weakest, dimmest object you can watch with a telescope? Similar phenomena going on in either case. And that's not clear. I mean, If the radio signal is more and more coherent, in other words, if all the energy of that signal is gathered in a very small number of megacycles, there's very little residual FM modulation, and if the carrier frequency is well enough known, and if the receiver has a narrow enough bandwidth, that's what's going on with Voyager. As Voyager gets further out, the signal by 60 dB, every time you double the distance, you get 60 dB less signal strength. Let me drop.
Can we use some Joe Taylor techniques, Dick?
Yes and no. Joe Taylor, the WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor. I can't think of the names of the other two subsets of that. Anyhow, those techniques will allow you to transmit a very small data set. You don't have a conversation with that. And it's very carefully designed to send call letters, single strength, and get Rogers, so to speak. And so it's kind of limited. And would those techniques, would a Reed-Solomon detection technique make an improvement on the communication to Voyager? I think the answer is no. It's one of these situations where you trade threshold versus time. In other words, as the signal gets weaker and weaker, whereas you have the ability to command Voyager to transmit the data slower and slower, very similar to what happens with high speed versus slow speed Morse code. If you're transmitting Morse code at 1,000 characters per second by way of a machine, you're going to occupy a certain amount of bandwidth. And unless the receiver has that bandwidth, it's not going to get the data. And if you can slow down the data rate, and if the carrier is well enough known, then you use a very narrow bandwidth of the receiver. You receive less and less noise as you make the receiver more and more narrow, but the data rate that's maximum that's allowed in that narrow bandwidth also goes down. So you tell Voyager, hey, you used to talk to me at 250 bits per second. Your signal's getting kind of weak. You've now got to go down to 150 or 50 bits per second. Send me the same message, but spend a little longer time doing it. And down here at Goldstone, we'll use a phase lock loop receiver. Let me drop this. With a narrow enough bandwidth, and we'll get a good bit error rate, good signal-to-noise ratio, and there comes the data. And communicating with Voyager, I think the round-trip time is something like 37 hours. Or is it 35 hours? In that order. From the time you send an uplink signal and it starts sending it back down to you with data on it, that round-trip time is something like 34 or 35 hours. Boy, is that a long delay line. That is at the absolute limit in delay lines that you and I have ever heard of. But it's telling us what those particles are like out there. The solar wind has almost disappeared and is now looking at galactic wind. I'm pretty sure everyone has decided that Voyager has left the solar system and it's now in the galactic system. It has left the building and is moving away from us at, what is it now? Paul gave it to us earlier. Oh, where did I write that down? Anyhow, it's around 1 million miles a day. 3.5 astronomical units per year, more than 40,000 miles an hour. That thing is moving away from us. That's really out there. What a piece of hardware. Launched in 1977. That's what, something like 37 years ago. The fact that they can keep a nuclear power supply running that long, let me drop it.
It's just over 35 hours there.
Okay. I told you once, I told you a million times, don't exaggerate. Thank you, Paul. Just a little over 35 hours, 17 hours, I think it was 17 fraction hours one way. And to keep that traveling wave tube operating that long, I'm amazed. I presume they turn off the filament in between, but there I'm not sure. Because as you cycle the filament on and off, thermal cycling can age it. I know that during the early days of some of the super big computers that we were building with vacuum tubes in the old days, they came to the conclusion that they never turned it off. Maybe the filament's running continuously. You get bit of life out of the vacuum tubes. Whether or not they're doing that with the traveling wave tube, I don't know. But to have a vacuum tube and X-band transmitter survive for 35, 37 years, what a piece of hardware. I believe there were two vacuum tubes, two traveling wave tubes, on that system. There, I'm not sure. I'd like to believe that on the first one, they never switched to the backup one, on both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. You might know a little more about that one, Paul. Is there one traveling wave tube? And if so, that's it? Or is there really a backup and they haven't used the backup yet? WS2N, K2RIW in TechNet.
I never heard of a backup, but I was awfully curious over the last year or so, since Voyager topic has come out.
the traveling wave tube, and there's a vacuum there. But is it a true vacuum? You know, do they have some kind of a gas in there? Or is it a true vacuum? Or is it the glass broke? I mean, it's in the vacuum of space. You know, would it keep working?
In order to get full performance out of a traveling wave tube, you need the best vacuum you can get there, Paul. You're trying to form an extremely tight, focused beam of electrons going down the center of the helix. You're launching a signal into the helix. The helix is something like 15 wavelengths long. You have this very tiny, intense beam of electrons, very carefully focused, going down the length of the tube. I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me that traveling wave tube is close to a foot long, and you want every one of those electrons not to hit another air molecule or anything else, that's the world's best vacuum you want inside that tube. Otherwise, they start scattering and terrible things happen. So that's not a gas-filled tube. You put an inert gas inside of an incandescent light bulb to increase the life of the tube by slowing down the rate at which the tungsten evaporates into the vacuum. Well, that's what you do with an incandescent light bulb. That traveling wave tube has got the best vacuum they could pump on the traveling tube, followed by the best gettering device inside, so that even the molecules of air that you couldn't remove by multiple stages of vacuum pump, still the gettering is supposed to act like flypaper and catch the rest of those active air molecules that are floating around in there. The bottom line of this is that we amateurs who have got all kinds of funny friends in funny places, Jim Vogler, WA7DJO, for instance, is the number one guy in the United States living in Phoenix, Arizona, who can really have all kinds of friends that can get him a very expensive traveling wave tube. Some of these high-power traveling wave tubes the microwave ham radio operators are using had original prices like $30,000. When you pick up one of those tubes, you want to be darn careful that you know darn well there's no replacement. And if somebody has given you one of those, by whatever means, you want to make sure you don't damage it. And what you want to do in a case like that is a so-called wake-up procedure. For the first few days, you apply nothing but filament power and air cooling to that tube to light up the filament, to light up the inside of the tube so that the gettering becomes activated so that the spare air molecules that have outgassed. Let me give you an explanation on that. There's a lot of metallic.
Helps the life of the tube because you don't have any 14.7 pounds of pressure trying to get in.
Well, the tube started off on planet Earth. And you would say, well, I don't have to have a real high vacuum. I'll just have a bunch of holes in the side of the tube and let the air drain out. And I'll launch it into space where there's a hard vacuum. Good sounding concept. Grumman used that concept on the OAO, Astronomical Orbiting Observatory, I think it was. They used that concept. They launched it into space, turned it on, it arced over, and I believe it killed the power supply. You think you've got a bunch of holes in the side of the tube, and you think the air molecules are going to run out and disappear. Uh-oh. They're pesky little things. Some of them will bounce around, and by Murphy's Law, some of them will bounce in some way, in such a way that they never find the hole and they never leave. So you want to start off with an extremely good vacuum. But what I'm starting to say is, if you and I get a hold of one of these $35,000 tubes, you want to make sure you don't damage it. The first thing you do is a wake-up procedure, which consists of only filament for some number of days, and maybe even you slowly sneak up on the filament voltage, so that the gettering inside gets a chance to capture the outgassing molecules. You've got a whole lot of chunks of metal and filament materials and whatever inside the tube. And when it's sitting there in an extremely hard vacuum, all of that is slowly outgassing. So if the tube is sitting on the shelf for a couple of years, it is slowly contaminating itself. And by way of the wake-up procedure, you do a recovery of those outgassed particles. Hopefully the gettering materials inside will capture all that so that the first time you apply high voltage to the tube, it doesn't arc over and do damage. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
Very good. Okay. What brings to mind one more question, though. If you were to launch Voyager today, 2013, would you put a traveling wave tube in that, or is there another solid-state means of sending a signal back to Earth 35 years later?
Question also.
Yeah, John recognized. Without a doubt, there are solid-state devices these days that'll give you those number of watts of output at that frequency. That's the good news. However, what's the longevity of that kind of material? The best gallium arsenide, gallium phosphide, indium phosphide, all these exotic materials that go into field effect light transistors and silicon nitride and whatever, these advanced solid state materials, they all have a certain migration rate. In other words, the dopants you put in there to create the N and the P materials in just the right places, those materials are slowly migrating. And would one of those amplifiers, in those crazy temperatures it's being exposed to in space, would they survive for 37 years? That's not clear. If that thing was had to have high reliability for a year, without a doubt, it'd make it solid state today. But if I wanted it to guarantee life of 37 years, would I choose a high vacuum traveling wave tube, or would I choose solid state? I don't think that's clear, because the accelerated life test that you can do can tell you whether or not your power supply is going to have insulating materials that are going to slowly degrade. Let me drop and slowly arc over, and the insulation within your transformers and whatever, and your diode is going to survive. But the real exotic high-power X-band amplifier, high-power X-band amplifier, would I trust it for 37 years? I'd lose a lot of sleep on that one. That ain't clear, because I'm not sure your accelerated life tests are really going to give you an indication of that kind of longevity. I mean, you expand the temperature and you do all kinds of shake, rattle, and roll and salt spray and everything else. You can accelerate the grief that a chunk of electronics is being subjected to in your laboratory, and you think you're artificially aging it. Well, you're artificially aging many of the characteristics, not all of them. Could you really anticipate the migration rates of the dopant materials within the solid-state device and its level of slowly breaking down, losing gain, losing power output, and so on? Next time I talk to some of my reliability friends, I'm going to hit them with some of these questions. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
We've got to find out about New Horizons. Let me think about that, Dick. I'll find out what that thing's got. John?
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, your opinion on this with the filament voltage. Now, from my understanding, the work I've done, we have fuses and filaments that fail from metal fatigue being turned on and off. Do you think maybe they just reduce the filament voltage? Would that be beneficial? Or do you actually think they could be turning it off and on? What do you think about that? Back to you, Dick.
If I had my druthers, John, and I wanted to make sure that I get maximum life out of that traveling wave tube, and I know that the thermal cycling of the filament is one of the modes of failure. Just to give you an example on that, in the case of an incandescent light bulb, you know that as you lower the voltage that you put to that incandescent light bulb, you increase the life. You wouldn't believe how fast that life increases. I think it's 1/12 power. Some ridiculous big number. Instead of feeding your incandescent light bulb 115 volts, you feed it 109 volts and sacrifice a little bit of extra light output. You may get 4 or 5 times the life out of the bulb. It happens very fast. As such, the filament on that traveling wave tube, I'd want to bring it up in a very slow, controlled manner. When I turn on the tube, I wouldn't just hit it with full voltage. You know that whenever a light bulb fails, it's very slowly, some little portion of the filament has slowly been evaporating more rapidly than some other portion. That portion gets thinner. Therefore, that portion gets hotter. Therefore, that portion gets evaporates more rapidly, and it becomes a runaway condition. Finally, the day comes along that as you flip the switch, you hear the light bulb go pop, and it's all over. If you very slowly raise the filament voltage on turn on, and very slowly raise it on turn off, I think you can minimize the thermal cycling stress, minimize many of these failure mechanisms, and I think you get the mostest for the leastest. And would that be better than leaving it on continuously? I'm not sure, but that's one of the questions I'm going to ask Paul. Do they leave that filament on continuously, or is that very carefully controlled power supply, very slowly, gently waking it up each time they turn it on?
Repeater, timeout.
I don't know the answer to that one. And of all the websites you and I can go to, Paul, we're now getting very deep into the design of that instrument. And as I've often said, when studying the system that was used by Apollo to keep communication with the astronauts, their only connection with all of society, you got, 6 billion people on this planet, not one of them can see an astronaut when he's in lunar orbit. You take the biggest telescope we got, you aim it at that capsule, you'll see a white dot because the sun is shining off of it. And if you think you're going to see an astronaut waving his hand in the window and he's trying to give you a message, no way in hell. If that radio beam dies on that Apollo spacecraft, it's game over as far as communication is concerned. He's completely on his own. Same thing with that Voyager. Voyager is capable of making great measurements. If that traveling wave tube doesn't stay alive, you've got nothing. And so, is there enough information you and I can get our hands on that'll tell us how they turn on that filament of that tube, and is there only one tube? I give that to you as a challenge, Paul, because you and I are darn curious. I think it's going to be very difficult to get that deep into their information without talking to Mr. Stoner himself, the guy who is the principal investigator on that project. I don't know if we're going to know that one. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've seen Ed Stone in the interview, and he said the traveling wave tube is transmitting at 23 watts, I think he said, at this time. He never said whether or not they shut it off. I mean, it goes for a long time without needing to transmit. So I don't know what they do. Can you bring it down? Can you run a low voltage? You have to keep it, at one steady rate. Who knows, Dick? But I'm still thinking about trying to find out if they have this on the New Horizon. That thing went up about 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, due to orbit Pluto in 2015, not orbit, but past Pluto. It's going to do a flyby. And then it's going to go on to the Kuiper Belt and transmit for, maybe decades from now on in. Similar to Voyager. Does that have a traveling wave tube? Got to find out, Dick. Don't know.
We'll run this by again. When New Horizons goes whipping by Pluto, and it leaves the solar system as far as Pluto is concerned, will it be moving faster or slower than Voyager? Voyager had 2 or 3 gravity assist flybys, but New Horizons started off with a bigger launching rocket. So when it leaves Pluto, which one has a higher velocity? I am guessing New Horizons is transmitting on X-band, 8.5 gigs roughly, because I'm not sure that we've perfected the deep space network for KU or KA frequencies. In other words, the 20 gig and 30 gig frequencies. I think it's going to use 8.5 gigs. You might know that one. And I think there's a medium good chance that it is a traveling wave tube. That traveling wave tube, let me drop it, is a peculiar object. With good design, it can easily have 40, 45 decibels of gain. You put in a milliwatt signal, and you can get a fraction of a kilowatt out of one of those things. I've seen them do it. A lot of gain in one tube. And the tube has a peculiar characteristic of power output versus dissipation. In order for the beam to be properly focused, the beam must be at a very specific voltage and a very specific current flows in that beam. So you put full power into the beam. And if you're not using the tube to amplify a signal, all that power of that accelerated beam goes into the collector and makes it hot. You start pouring power into the tube where you want, you're giving it drive power and you want power output. It is subtracting energy from that beam by slowing down those electrons. That's the mechanism of a coupling. Therefore, when you expect, when you demand maximum power output of the tube, because you've slowed down the electrons, they hit the collector at a lower velocity and you get less heat. The tube runs cooler when you demand maximum power output. Ain't that crazy? WS2N, KQLIW.
Very good. I'm hearing enough talent here. New Horizon on an 11-year flight, I believe it was, so direct shot. That was launched by Atlas 505. That means the bearing was the widest diameter, roughly 5 meters, and it had 5 booster rockets attached to it. 551. What am I saying? 551. That's the first 5 is widest diameter, 5 meters. The second 5 meant it had 5 boosters attached to it, and then the 1 means that it had 1 Centaur rocket as a booster stage. So, but that was the biggest Atlas configuration that they've ever launched with the 5 boosters on it. So yeah, it was a powerful blast. Direct shot, did pick up, believe a gravity assist off Jupiter, but that was about it. The other ones, Voyager had all the different gravity assists, and New Horizon didn't have it. Let's see, let me think about this. New Horizon did not, it did go past Jupiter, so it had an assist from that, but the other ones had the assist from Saturn and Jupiter. I believe they even came around past Earth. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So it would never catch Voyager. Both Voyagers would be 8,000 miles faster than New Horizons.
Yeah, I know that Voyager has had a big head start, so will New Horizon catch it? No way. But you believe that at the rate at which it's going to fly by Jupiter, you believe that New Horizon will be moving slower than Voyager was when it moved by the orbit of Pluto? Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, when it moves past Pluto into the Kuiper Belt, it'll be going 8,000 miles an hour slower than the Voyagers. Voyagers are roughly between 40 and 50,000. So, so therefore it could never catch, doesn't matter how many years ahead Voyager was. In other words, if New Horizon was 8,000 miles an hour faster, somewhere down the road, New Horizon would be the furthest spacecraft, you know, decades and decades from now. But never will happen. It's at Pluto. When it leaves, it'll be 8,000 miles slower than both Voyager 1, Voyager 2.
Now, the way New Horizons is going to whip by Pluto and take photographs as it goes whizzing by, my question is, do you believe New Horizons is going to stay in the ecliptic plane? Because I believe the Kuiper Belt is a band of material that's all in the ecliptic plane. So if it's going to stay in the ecliptic plane, it's going to encounter the Kuiper Belt. And that could be some very interesting measurements. Way beyond that is the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud, I think, is not necessarily in the ecliptic plane. I think the Oort cloud is one great big bubble around the whole Dawn solar system, in which case I guess each of the Voyagers are going to eventually encounter the Oort cloud. But because they're so far out of plane, I think they're going to miss the Kuiper Belt Bunch of guesses on my part, Paul. WS2M, K2RAW.
And a Kuiper Belt is much closer, man. Yeah, and that's on the ecliptic plane, and that's the way New Horizon is going to go. Voyager 1 is going, to the northern part of the ecliptic plane, about 33, 34 degrees off of the ecliptic, and Voyager 2 is going south of the ecliptic plane, roughly about 38, I think, degrees off the ecliptic plane. So, yeah, you're right. And then the Oort cloud, yes, there's a sphere around it, but that extends, you know, maybe one-third the distance to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, approximately Centauri now. When I was a kid, it was Alpha Centauri. But, so that's how far that goes out. You know, now that's, you know, probably, you know, thousands of years before it ever gets to the Oort cloud, maybe.
Yeah, we can have some fun on this one, Paul. Somebody asked you, how's Voyager doing? Voyager 2? Oh, it went south. It went south with the ecliptic plane. If I haven't confused Voyager 1 versus Voyager 2. And so, since the Oort cloud is so far away, I think you said a third of the way to Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri. Wow. A third of the way, since those objects are nearest stars, 4 and a fraction light years. A third of that is more than 1 light year. So, in your and my lifetime, it doesn't sound like Voyager 1 or 2 is going to get anywhere near the Oort cloud. So they're really in dark space. But I'm sure you want to make that vacuum tube, the traveling wave tube, with a really good high vacuum. Let me drop.
I have a question, Dick.
Okay, I was going to tell Paul something, but it'll wait. Go ahead, John.
Okay, well, just back to the filament subject. I don't know if you've noticed this, but over the many years, thousands of hours that I've worked in this trade, I've noticed that identical lamps, bulbs, say 100-watt bulb, when they are mounted globe down, Edison base up, they last a lot longer than when they're mounted globe up, Edison base down. I wondered if you have noticed that. And I only know of one thing that's not congruent with both operations. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you think the light bulb is giving out light, John. You may not know it's really sucking dark. Obvious by the fact when the bulb finally burns out, you see a whole bunch of those black particles inside. That's when it's filled up with dark. So when you mount it, Edison threads up, you've got a lot more room there for the dark particles to gather. I'm pulling your leg, John, and you know that. No, I don't know why that would be. Why should it upside down last longer? Craziness. Huh. I can picture when it's mounted upside down, because there's a small amount of inert gas inside, and I'm now thinking about the way the inert gas will move by way of convection. And if it's moving up toward the base, because the base is upside down, I'm guessing that the greater cooling of that gas going through convection can take place. And so therefore the bulb is running at a cooler temperature at the filament, is my guess. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Good point, Dick. I never thought of that. But what I found, which was not congruent, but not in all applications, when it is mounted vertically with globe up, Edison base down, it's usually in a table lamp or some structure that is touched by the human. Extra vibration, maybe a little more metal fatigue, but then it also applies to ones that are mounted in sconce lights on the wall. And this has been proven by records. When I noticed it, I went and looked at the records in some of the industry and the bulb replacements, and the ones that are globed down do last longer by numbers, by a considerable amount of hours. And I was just wondering what could be the difference. And you brought up a good point. Thank you, Dick.
Roughly how much is the difference, John? Are the ones that are mounted upside down and last longer, are they lasting 10 or 15% longer? What's your rough guess as to the increase in longevity?
According to the rough records, it seemed to be about a 60% better longevity with them globed down. And I don't know if anybody else has ever noticed that in their home use of bulbs, but it would be interesting if anybody else had comments on it. But I thought maybe you had noticed it, because I know you pay attention to silly things, too.
60%, that's a lot. Wow. And you could easily get 60% of increase by just running the filament at 109 volts instead of 115. What's really going on with the lower voltage? That the filament is running colder. That's the main mechanism by which it lasts longer. So with the bulb down and the threads up, I see a mechanism by which the inert gas inside flowing by convection gets a little bit more cooling, therefore the filament runs cooler. So that's a guess as to the mechanism.
How about actual conduction also through the base in the vertical mode?
Okay. I'm having trouble with that one. One of the laws of thermodynamics tells you that the heat always flows from the hot toward the cold. And if heat has to flow up versus down, I don't think that counts. If the socket is colder, you're going to get some cooling. And therefore, the glass support mechanisms and the wire support mechanisms inside for the filament, if by whatever means you can keep them cooling the gas, because the filament is in direct contact with the inert gas inside. So by a mechanism of cooling that gas, the filament runs cooler, get extra life. But whether the heat has to flow up or flow down out of the socket, I'm not convinced that that's a factor. Over to you, John. KQLAW.
I agree with John, WS2S.
You have noticed it, Paul?
I have, an octet light, my ham shack. And I set up this thing, this light here. Oh, I don't know. It's got to be 10 years ago, and it's still here. I've never changed a bulb on it. But I think the heat, what you said, John, that metal would really get hot. And if the metal part is below the globe, that's extra heat that's going to rise up the bulb hotter. If the metal is above it, that metal, is going to radiate the heat above the globe, keeping the whole globe cooler. I don't know, John. I think you're onto that with conduction.
Yeah, I got a question for you though, John. When you mount the bulb threads down versus threads up, the structure around the bulb, how closely does that come into the vicinity of the bulb? How much outside air is able to flow around it? Can the glass bulb be easily cooled better in one of those lighting fixtures than the other? Over to you, John, KQLAW.
Interesting point, Dick. A normal table lamp has pretty much a good airflow. The convection is good. Where when you have something hanging in a globe, I think the heat is trapped. It's near the ceiling. I'm not sure if that's detrimental or not, but that's a good point.
Enter Exchange.
Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I forgot about it. Would you be able to next session to cover the material that I have sent you?
Give us a couple of hints. The material you sent us is on the subject of...
There are two subjects, one just to discuss with it, whichever one you want. The one was the susceptance standard and calibrated susceptance measurement of small reactive discontinuities. That was the old, very simple instrument that was also admittance meter and... what was good about it, that works with the bias insertion units, and what is good about it, that all of those...
Okay.
that is being used for UHF transmitting antenna tune-up. So that was one of the subjects, and I sent you very much precise and concise literature about it. And since John is doing the experiment, the part of the length regulated coaxial pipe line is being utilized with it, and that leads to then calculation with the Smith chart for admittance, and the device looks pretty much simple, but it's absolute craft. In one you have a subsistence, in midi ohms you have admittance meter, you have conductance in midi ohms, and you have multiplying factors that will allow you to refer to the Smith chart. So that was one subject to discuss, and I sent you the number of pictures about the linking up.
Yeah, I was going to discuss that, if you give me a chance, and that is that admittance meter.
Yeah, but we have only 5 minutes, 10 minutes left, I have another subject, whichever one you like, and it was a little bit different look at three subjects by Miles Mathis, philosopher and scientist. That was gravity at the quantum level. That was also by him, the universal gravitational constant, and that was the electrical charge. Now, what was good about it is that he proposed that the charge is the mass of charge of the photons. And it will also show the permittivity of the free space is the misidentified constant that has nothing to do with the free space. And the value of the constant is actually the value of gravitational fields of the proton. So whichever one you would like to, I mean, we have a few minutes only, and this subject is required at least twice more or three times more.
The general radio admittance meter and those standard susceptance devices that are used for calibrating it was the best technique they had 20 or so years ago for measuring the specific impedance of a transmission line system. Since then, vector voltmeters and network analyzers, really the word I'm looking for, the network analyzers of today do, believe it or not, probably a more accurate job, certainly a much more rapid job. A good network analyzer will display on the Smith chart rather high accuracy information very, very rapidly. The main advantage of a modern day vector network analyzer is it's not only giving you direct display of the Smith chart information, but it's updating it 30 times per second. If you're using a modern day vector network analyzer to tune an antenna across a particular band of frequencies, as you're varying the controls, the sizes, you're bending the pieces of sheet metal, you're doing all kinds of things to the antenna under test. And if you're doing it with the right kind of remote tools, like small diameter pieces of wooden shaft, wooden skewers, that are long enough that you're standing outside of the field, the radio field of the antenna, and you're bending and pushing and varying a capacitor, squeezing a coil, doing whatever you want to do. And you look at, say for instance, you're designing an antenna that you want it to cover 902 to 928 megahertz inclusive. That 28 megahertz, 26 megahertz region, you want the antenna to perform well simultaneously across all of that. To watch that happen live, 30 frames per second on a vector network analyzer, you see exactly what's happening as you do whatever manipulations you're doing. And therefore, you literally can test, let me pick a number, 100 individual design variations in 1 hour with a modern vector network analyzer. By way of the admittance meters that we used to use, the good news is it gave you a nice accurate piece of information one frequency at a time. Then you turn the dials, you move to a new frequency, you recalibrate the system, you take another data point, and you put one more dot on the chart. Therefore, just to sweep across the chart in the old days and to plot the data as to what is the before...
Repeater, timeout.
And plot the performance of what is your antenna. It takes you an hour, maybe even 2 hours, to get one single plot in the old days. Good accuracy, as long as you don't make any mistakes on all the individual steps, but it takes you an hour to get one plot. Whereas with a modern-day vector network analyzer, you get that plot in a 30th of a second. Can you imagine if you're doing a tuning procedure, and you might settle on the center frequency with the old admittance meter, and you do whatever fiddling you can on the antenna to make the admittance the most desirable number you can get at that one frequency. Then you have to go to all those other frequencies, make all of those measurements, and do all of that plotting to find out what happened at all the other frequencies because of the last test you made. The ratio at which you can do tuning with a modern-day vector network analyzer, I could make a case, but I can now do it close to 100 times faster than I used to. It's a good piece of instrument. Had a lot of good history. General Radio did an excellent job of designing that particular instrument. Let me drop. It did an excellent job of designing that in its day. But as I said, if you're trying to do a tuning procedure, and I just lived through an episode of my life where I was designing antennas where the average amateur or commercial product, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is pretty good. And if you buy the premium antenna, it's guaranteed to be a 1.5 standing wave ratio across the band of frequencies of interest. If you pay top dollar, you can buy antennas that'll cover 902 to 928 megs with the VisWire is guaranteed to be lower than 1.5. In the application I was designing those antennas, I didn't need 1.05, 1.5, 1.4, 1.5. I needed 1.05. I needed a reflection coefficient better than minus 20 dB, minus 25 desired. To get a standing wave ratio that low across that many megahertz simultaneously by the old tuning technique, I'm rather positive I wouldn't live long enough. I did that multiple times on multiple antenna designs using a modern-day vector network analyzer. I think you can see the difference. And so, good piece of history, not as valuable today. Over to you for further information on this one, Wes. N2XJN, you got 2 minutes left. KQLIW.
Okay, thank you very much for the information. American quality. That what was available at that time. But that is right now a simple way of acquiring the measurement for those who are not fortunate enough to have a vector network analyzer for it, at least some of it, or play for it for just for the fun of it. $50, $40 for the complete set. Thank you very much, and I hope if you be willing to discuss the subject next week, there you go.
Very fine. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1,476. We've settled some of the unknowns of the radio world. And when Bernie gets a chance, because I issued it very late tonight, you'll eventually find on Bernie's site, K2YO, it's what's the Hunt Family... Bernie@huntfamily.org, you'll eventually see a copy of my first draft of this dissection of a dipole, the most basic of all antennas. I've got an entirely different way of looking at what happens inside. How does it really do its magic? And so I've shipped a copy of that to you, John, to Glenn, to Lou. Who else did I ship a copy of it to? And, of course, to Bernie. So we'll get a chance next week to discuss that, among other things, if you want to. Okay. John, you might want to say some words. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I'd like to thank everybody for participating this week.
as enjoyable net. And by the way, Dick, I have the equipment that Wesley's talking about, that general radio stuff. And, you know, it takes up a whole bench. It takes hours to set up. Very inconvenient to use, but it is good, it is accurate. But you can't buy it for $50. I'm sorry. You may be able to buy individual pieces, but if you look at the amount of equipment there with the generators and the bias supplies and stuff, you're talking about in the past 10 years that I know of. But I'm sure you're familiar with it, Dick.
Okay, it's a good piece of history, as I see it, John. In its day, it was a state of the art. It was the best you had. But like everything else, time moves us on. We found better ways. Bye-bye, you all. 73, be kind to each other. Paul, if you want to say anything, into WS2N, KQRIW. Bye-bye. See you down the line, Paul. And look out for those filaments. They're very important. And everybody thinks that solid state is the whiz bang of today, and that vacuum tubes are no longer any good. Ain't quite true. Those certain exotic kinds of vacuum tubes are going to be with us for another few decades on transmitting functions, in my opinion. KQRIW, to be clear. Yeah, but the next question a reliability person is going to ask is, how many times has he done it? If he built just one in the last 35 years, that's nice. That doesn't tell you that serial number 3 and 4 are going to do that. You have to have a statistically significant number of units that are being tested. It's obvious we're talking about a lot of bucks and a lot of time. Except for the Burke organization, I don't think, the Beck organization. Not many of us can afford that one, John. KQRIW. Bye-bye.
For visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you. N to ZEP and to PPN.
Good morning, Rich. How are things by you?
Fine, fine. And by you?
A little soggy, but other than that, fine. How are the roads?
Wet, but everything looks good.
You get a jump on me? I'm just starting out.
I think I got a little bit of a jump on you. I'm just getting off the Wancha onto the Northern. So I'm in the three-laner.
All right. You'll probably get a little bit ahead of me, because I'm still on Merrick Avenue.
Well, I'm coming up to New York Post Avenue over here, so I might have a little more than a little jump on you.
I don't think you're going to be needing the cold weather gear today. And if everything goes as predicted, you should be able to get rid of the wet weather gear by the middle of the morning.
Hey, they said by 7 a.m. it'll be gone. So I shouldn't even need the wet weather gear at all. But I did throw a sweatshirt in the car in case I work late tonight because the temperature's supposed to drop later in the day. Not a lot, but I don't feel like being uncomfortable later.
Yeah, well, tomorrow's supposed to start getting chilly again. But it was nice. I had to be dressed formal this week, and it was nice not to have to put a coat on over the tuxedo.
Sure, you want everybody to see you in your tuxedo, not your overcoat.
It's just a lot more comfortable having just one layer out instead of two or three.
Uh-huh.
So how's the patient's wrists and hands?
Both stitches are out. Got to look at the incision. Not bad. And she's actually considering having the other hand done as soon as everything is back to normal with this one.
If I remember correctly, the incision should be only about tops 2 inches on the inside of the wrist.
Yeah, hers is about inch and a half. It's a little bit lower than others we've seen, but I guess he had to do more work because she had such a collapsed tunnel.
The trick is to release everything without damaging the ligaments and the nerves going through it.
Well, he seems to have been able to have done that because she doesn't seem to have any nerve damage.
The ligaments are the easy parts, the nerves, as you said. Ligaments you can push out of the way. Nerves, you got to handle them more delicately.
Yes, yes indeed.
I've seen orthopedists work, and I've seen some of the tools they've used. I've been in the OR with them. Some of the work is akin to what you would do if you're in the wood shop. And I'm talking with the hammers and the chisels.
Hammers, chisels, saws, drills, anchors, socket wrenches.
You take a look at, you compare an orthopedic surgeon to a neurosurgeon, and you're talking about two ends of the spectrum on the average of the delicacy of their work.